Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 9th, 2020, and welcome to episode 219 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and databases. Woohoo! Paul happened to notice that 219 decimal is 0xDB in hexadecimal, you know, like you do. And so we decided that today's host topic would be databases. So that's what we're going to talk about. But first, we're going to go around the table and find out how everybody is. So I'm going to go in no discernible order. Carrington, how are you doing?
You're going in the order of most awesome to other. Apparently. Actually, I'm doing fantastic, Earl.
Excellent. Well, what about you, Jack?
Yeah, I'm doing good. It's unusually warm weather here in Stockholm for a change. It's around 80. And of course, Swedish homes don't usually have air conditioning, and mine is no exception. So pretty warm. But.
Well, and for those of you who are listening and not watching us on YouTube, which is most of you, I'll point out that behind Jack is a very impressive wall of stringed instruments. I think some are guitars and a couple, I think, are ukuleles. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. I've had these for a long time and I play them pretty frequently, and I've had them usually they're tucked away in closets and things. And every time I'm going to play something, it's a bit of a hassle to sort of pull it out and figure out where I'm going to put the case and that kind of thing. And now I just decided, okay, I'm just going to hang these up. So I bought hangers and put them all up this afternoon. And so far, it kind of freaks me out every time I see it, because I'm used to this wall having all this stuff on it. And I walk past, it's like, oh my God, what is this? What's happening? But it's good.
Yeah, it's very impressive. Very nice.
Thanks.
It's also good that it's before the first time you need to dust them.
Yeah.
I have my entire collection of Apple IIs behind me as well still. Feels good thing at home. Actually, I have plants now. Two tiny plants.
Oh, very good.
Look at that. I got roommates.
So now you have something to water, something to care for.
They hope.
If they're lucky.
They're not contributing to rent, so they get what they get. We'll see.
So what do you think, Paul? How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Things are also warm here and also not air conditioned here. But still seem like I'm still kind of recovering from the Kansas Fest thing. It really doesn't seem like it was as long ago as it actually was. But
it was really, really fun.
Yeah.
It was.
Anyway, that's about it.
Yeah, it is. You guys did a great job pulling off that whole event. That was just wonderful.
I'm just happy I don't have to be the one who has to edit the Mega Podcast this year.
Yes.
Or any year, frankly. But that's on you, Paul. And there was like 9,000 people on it. So
yeah, it's just about done. It's actually I've mixed it down now 5 times, each time finding some kind of level problem between people. But So
is this the most number of voices you've had on a podcast that you've had to edit?
I think so. Yeah, there were more people in this Mega Podcast than usual. And also, usually this is just in a room, like where some people are close to the microphone and some people are not, and there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. So those are not so bad to edit because you just basically give up. Mm-hmm. But it was somewhat of a challenge, but I'm now done with that part. So,
and as you're hearing this, you'll know whether or not Paul succeeded.
in that challenge. Oh, yeah, because it'll be on the stream before this one.
Yep. Right.
Or maybe so nobody ever hears this one.
So send all of your critiques to feedback at rcrpodcast.com.
Perfect.
Feedback is spelled P-A-U-L.
So what do you think? I think we should have a show. And, you know, going with Paul's hexadecimal stylings here, we can talk about databases. So
it was that or like volume. One of the two.
Well, I like databases better.
The hexadecimal stylings of Paul Hexen. I like it.
What order should we go in? Paul, since you suggested the topic, maybe you should go first. Because when it comes to me, I'm just going to yammer on. So I love databases.
Yeah, I was trying to think. It's kind of a little of a broad topic. But I think I've mentioned before that I had some sort of like consulting experiences with databases kind of early on back as a young programmer, charging less than a programmer should, no doubt. That's the thing. You hire the kids, right? They don't know. It's better than a paper route.
But, right. We've all had those projects.
Right. But so I worked for a while at a hotel, sort of like a luxury hotel that was in the town that I grew up in, and but I was recruited from the, I guess it was probably even the junior high at that point, and so I worked in the computer room, and they had me writing the sort of front desk stuff was written in DBase 2, and the owner of the hotel was sort of keen on all the new tech, and so had outfitted every place with Epson QX10s. So that's why I know the QX10 is because there were many of these, and I was given one to take home even. So I had a QX10 on my bed that I would type on. although actually, to be honest, about half the time I was also calling VBSs because it had a 1200 baud modem and my own computer did not. So, that was kind of just as databases were starting to get, you know, or the computers at least were powerful enough that they could start to do relational things. And DBase was kind of neat because it had a sort of a template system. So, you know, you design the database, you could template the screens, and it would sort of build the code for you and stuff like that. So that was also kind of a neat introduction to development environments of that sort. I've spent a fair amount of time writing the stuff I had to do for work, but also databases that would organize my cassette collections because I had an absurd number of cassettes. As I went to college, I raided everybody that I, you know, everyone I knew, I went and like taped all of their records. And so I had, you know, 45 boxes of, you know, these cassettes that I'd copied off of people, and I didn't, you know, but they're all, I had to be able to find the things. So I had wrote a little database to look those up. Later, I made an even more ridiculous one for VHS tapes in Perl. But
that collecting bug has totally left you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that was, I've grown out of that.
Space isn't an issue anymore, right?
I'm not actually sure what else to say, except that I really did enjoy that. You know, I started with DBase. I went on to do sort of some Foxbase programming and FoxPro later on. And
I had the exact same experience, DBase, then yeah, into Foxbase and into FoxPro.
Yeah. And it got sort of more and more kind of like not exactly consumer friendly, but I mean like less requiring less programming, you know, more of just painting the thing that you want. Anyway, yeah, I'll leave it to the next person, and I'll think of something to interject later.
All right. Well, Carrington, you had a thought there. Why don't you go next?
I have a thought. I think the first database program I ever used would have been on the Apple II, in a sense, because through AppleWorks, kind of using spreadsheet things, and I kind of organically grew into using full-on database things out of just piles of data and spreadsheets and making tables in word processors and stuff, like this desire to be able to arrange and collate data. But then on the Mac is where I started actually using dedicated database programs. And exactly like Paul, I started with DBase or DBase 2, I think, and then Foxbase I used quite a bit of, which was basically a clone of DBase 2. But my memory was, it was like faster and had this GUI and stuff, or GUI. I used a program called Double Helix for a bit. For the most part, in the 1980s and then into the early 90s, the database software I used was whatever my client was using, and they told me I had to make a new thing in it. So I never picked database software. I did some stuff in 4D, in fourth dimension. I did two or three things in that Double Helix, which also was a thing with a graphical, you know, quote unquote programming language, sort of. I did stuff in HyperCard. I had clients who on early Macs were using HyperCard, or a lot of times HyperCard or SuperCard as a front end with a plugin that would let you link to a database. So a lot of doing stuff like that. I used something called Omnis 3, but I think it was actually Omnis 1, 2, and 3, which were all, I never could understand what the difference between them were. And I think one was like super simple and not relational, and then 2 was mystery, and 3 was profits, because like 3 was the one you could actually build applications in. So I did a lot of Omnis 3, but it seemed to be just like you got all three of them, and I never really understood. I often didn't know what I was doing back then, which is another reason people didn't pay me a ton, to be honest. but it wasn't until I started using FileMaker, which I think first was Claris. In fact, I think Claris FileMaker 2 was the first version I used. And then eventually FileMaker was its own thing, and FileMaker Pro. And that was kind of the first database that I actually really liked. Like, I really enjoyed using FileMaker, and I used it for years, right into the 90s. And in modern times, a couple times when I thought about, oh, I want to make a database thing or something, and I don't feel like doing this in MySQL, which is what I use everything for nowadays. Maybe I'll use FileMaker. I'll do it on my own computer. It'll be fun. It'll be like retro. But then you go to like FileMaker.com and it's, okay, we've got 17,000 versions of them. Here are the words. Here are the names. Here are the pricing. Maybe that's per user. Maybe it's per month. Maybe it's Wim. I didn't even know what to get. I was like, I have no idea how to give you money. I don't know how to. So FileMaker has left me in its dust. Don't even understand it anymore. I'm too old. But that period in the maybe was super late 90s, but or late 80s, but I think into early 90s is when I switched to using MySQL, and that kind of was a change. But up until that, it was Foxbase was the thing I liked most when I got to use it. And then HyperCard for simple things when I got to use that for personal things. But then it was FileMaker was like my go-to Mac-based database software. And I didn't really use anything outside of the Mac for that whole period. And I think those weren't particularly popular when it comes to enterprise things. But I was a Mac guy, so I only got hired for that. I don't know. That's me.
What is SuperCard?
SuperCard was like a HyperCard was awesome and wonderful. I love HyperCard. I miss HyperCard. But like a lot of things, I bet if I used it now, I'd be like, I don't miss HyperCard. But my memory of it is that I miss it. But one of its downside was it, for a while, had fixed card sizes, but later you could get them larger. But it was really designed to be black and white. And then with QuickTime and with like a color plugin, you could kind of shoehorn color into it. But it really wasn't a color-based thing. So SuperCard was like a competitor to HyperCard. Did everything that HyperCard would do, but also did color and was much easier to link to a database, all that kind of stuff. The reason I used SuperCard the first time, actually, was I had a friend of mine, who I won't name in case he listens to this, because I'm about to shame him. My family had a cyber cafe here in Toronto. At the time, it was actually the world's largest cyber cafe, massive thing, multiple floors, hundreds of things, and just multiple areas for business things. And we had product launches, just way too big for a cyber cafe. It was kind of a silly thing. But my friend hired him to create like the front end where people could come and swipe a card to log in and keep track of their time and buy more time on it and order from the cafe and like do all that stuff, did all the menuing, did all of that. And it was all working. It was all great. He said, okay, we're good to go. And then we had like a soft launch on like a Monday or Tuesday to bring out some press people. And then we were actually launching on like that Friday. And it was like an hour before the press got there. He said, you know, none of this actually works. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh God. So we canceled that. And I'm like, okay, I've got till Friday to create everything this company needs. And so I thought, okay, I'll do it like a rapid development thing. And that'll be what we actually launch with. And so I prototyped it in SuperCard saying, okay, let me kind of link to a database and get a front end and do things. I'll learn as I go. Cause I know HyperCard will be really simple. I can do this in 3 days. We're all good. And then for like the first 2 years, that's what this thing ran. So that's why I know SuperCard is it ran the front end for this. It linked to multiple locations. You see little swipe cards to read in. And all it was SuperCard just sticking things out and doing its best behind the scenes while I wrote up actual working software. So SuperCard saved my butt one time. So yay for SuperCard.
Wow.
Nice.
That is a fun story.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, super fun. I basically slept there for 3 days.
Yeah.
I can do this. I can do this.
Yeah. One of the things that was that I liked about Fox Pro when I finally reached Fox Pro 2.5 was that that actually was a way to bridge between Mac and Windows. So I didn't need to use Windows really, because all you needed to do was get the runtime for Windows, and you had a Windows application too.
I think, and that was only when it was Fox Pro, right? Not Fox Base, I think. I use both, but they conflate in my mind.
Yeah, I think Foxbase was I never used Foxbase on the PC. I in modern times have gotten a copy of it. It did exist, but I'm not sure that they were. I don't know how intercompatible they were.
Yeah.
Well, what about you, Jack? Databases.
Go.
You know, back in the day when I was, first interested in computers, the first 10, 15 years, I didn't touch databases at all. Like, I barely knew what it was. In fact, I remember by the time I left college, I still really didn't have an understanding of what a relational database even was. That's a pretty high bar for a computer science degree, but that's that's the way it was. But so in the mid-90s, that's when I started working with databases. And by that time, it was like the thing you guys are talking about of DBase and Foxbase, where the database is an application that has sort of a GUI layer as a part of it, a presentation layer as a part of it, was pretty much over, it seemed like. So I jumped straight into client-server stuff where we were building – I was working for a company. We were doing next-step things. We would do next-step applications that would talk through a database adapter to Oracle or Sybase or Informix or one of the other ones. And I really liked it once I got started. Once I saw the power of this and started learning SQL, learning how this stuff worked, I thought it was pretty great. And I still enjoy it. I don't do much with it these days, but since I'm working as an iOS developer, I'm not usually doing a lot of back end stuff. Mm-hmm. But whenever I'm involved in a team where I'm involved with people who are doing back end things, I tend to have opinions. Because I feel like I learned a lot of things 25 years ago that people, if you're new to it, you still have to learn it, And the principles of how to design, how to lay out your tables and design what goes where haven't changed that much. If you're going to do like a relational database and you're going to, figure out in advance, most of the ways you want to do it are probably about the same. So anyway, I still enjoy databases, but I've never really had the experience of these kind of like DBase and Foxbase kind of things that you guys are talking about. Unfortunately, it always seems like it was an interesting thing, but I just never, at the time I never had a thought in my head about what I would do with such a thing. So I just never dove into it.
It's funny. I hadn't thought of that. The way I deal with databases now is so different than it was back then. Back then it was, okay, I'm going to run a instance of FileMaker server or whatever. It's going to be in this company. Everyone runs their version of my app on their desktop and they link to that. And it's also local. And I don't even know if you could do that nowadays. Nowadays it's always, okay, over on that Apache server is going to run MySQL and that's where everything is. And then I'm going to make a website that just talks to it
right.
And spews things back and JavaScript deals with it. And that's like the only way I do it nowadays. So it is fundamentally a different approach to databases now than I did in the 90s or the 80s. I hadn't really thought about what a shift that was.
There was kind of a middle ground where you had individual desktop databases like a DBase or a Fox Pro or something like that. And then they went to where you could do that, but over a LAN. So you'd have the database files that actually lived on something like a Novell server or whatever. And people would... They would mount those shared network drives and connect up to the database. But you had to have special goodies in there to make sure you had record level locking so that people's updates didn't walk over the top of each other. And it was kind of clunky. I mean, there were a few systems that I can remember that worked like that, and they never worked really well. They would get out of sync or the database would be corrupted and you'd have to go restore from a backup or re-index it or something. When you got to the world of SQL with the client server kind of thing, those sort of problems went away, which was good. Because I don't think the things like DBase and things of that nature were ever really designed to be multi-user. It was kind of an add-on hack.
Mm-hmm. Definitely with FileMaker, I ran an instance of FileMaker for ages where in the company I was doing this for, all it would do is if somebody else was working on a record, when you opened it up at your end, there'd be like a little red light in the bottom corner to say, someone else is currently touching this. And if you don't look, you're like, whatever, let's just race to see who saves last. Whoever saves last gets it. It would just tromp all over things. I was like, oh, well. Yep.
Last right wins.
Yep. Yeah. And that probably doesn't happen much. Don't worry about it.
So also, they didn't cover anything like that in my computer science degree either, Jack. We talked about things like data structures, like linked lists and binary trees and, you know, the under the hood kind of thing. But in terms of relational databases, database normalization, you know, that kind of stuff, nothing. Not a word. Had to go out into industry to actually have any clue what that sort of stuff
was. Yeah, I too spent a lot of time on binary trees and linked lists and, okay, do this. And like, let's learn about the linear time versus, okay, and now implement it again. Yeah. Oh, goodness. Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, it's very theoretical, which is good. I mean, it's good to have those underpinnings. But at the same time, I know when I was done with college and opened up a Minneapolis newspaper to look at jobs, and there are, you know, hundreds of computer program jobs in the newspaper in those days. And they're all full of acronyms that not only did I not know these technologies, I didn't even know what it was. And just so it was like, I mean, obviously a computer science degree, at least where I attended college, it's not meant to be necessarily now you're ready to go work as a computer programmer on this stuff. It's more because it's about learning the underpinnings that are the same for everything, really.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and I found that some of that knowledge helped me understand why the database programs were doing the things that they were doing. Mm-hmm. So you could kind of get a sense of, okay, when I'm indexing a database, it is creating some sort of a binary tree lookup of the mm-hmm. records that are in the database.
Right.
So that's how it's able to pull things out so fast when you index it versus when you don't, just doing a linear search like Carrington was talking about.
But right. So you can look at a thing and you can tell, oh, this is a heap, this is a linked list, this is a hash table. You can't get a job, but you can know what things are. So way to go, you.
Exactly.
Yep.
So my database stuff, I did a bunch of things, but three things I think that are fun to maybe really quick talk about. We've talked about how the TRS-80 had a great version of the BASIC programming language, and the Disk BASIC in particular had really nice data lookup capabilities, sequential and random access data commands, as I recall. I don't recall exactly how they worked, but I know that they were in there and they were quick. So when I was in high school, there was a company that came to my high school computer science teacher and they said, hey, we do warranty work on these key punches. And sometimes people buy like 5 key punches, but they only get a warranty on one. And then when we come there, they go, oh, yeah, that one's in warranty. That's the one. And we don't know whether they're telling us the truth or not. So we need a database of all the systems that we have that are under warranty. Could you guys write it for us? So my teacher came to my friend Arthur and I. He said, hey, do you think you could write a program? So we did. We actually wrote them a nice little database program in TRS-80 Level 2 Disk BASIC that would keep track of all of their systems and let them know whether or not when somebody called them out that the system was under warranty. And we got paid for it, which was great. It was my first consulting job, and
cool.
I loved that.
Cool.
Yeah, that was fun. But then working with an actual database, it's funny, Paul and I have a little bit of a shared background here, QX10 and DBase 2. When I went to work for Epson, we actually, we produced a commercial product with DBase 2 that people could buy if they needed to support Epson products. The program was called TechniCall, Techni-CALL, and it was a technical database of different specifications and documents and that sort of thing for Epson printers. And DBase 2 had a runtime. I don't know how commonly this is known, but you could make a program with DBase 2 and then pseudo-compile it into, I don't know, it was some sort of, you know, P code, like middle ground code. But then if you gave that along with the runtime, people could run the DBase 2 program and they wouldn't have to have DBase 2 to do it. You just give them the program and the runtime, they were off and running. So a colleague of mine at Epson and I kind of traded off on releases for this product, and it had all the kind of, you know, drama of a release. Like, we had very strict release dates where I had to get the master floppy to the duplicator so that they could actually produce the product and spit it out and stuff like that. But we wrote it in DBase 2, and it was actually a really nice environment to write this. It had some really advanced features too. Like, you could bring up a document for a printer and different pieces of the document would show up in bold or in, you know, because the QX10 had different fonts and that kind of thing. So it was really neat. And then the last one I'll talk about was DBase 3 Plus. I think, honestly, of all the DBases, DBase 3 Plus was like when they hit peak DBase-ishness. It was really awesome. DBase 4 was just not really a winner. You know, but 3 Plus was amazing. And so our PC support department at Hughes Aircraft, where I worked, we had to handle like dozens of different support requests and procurement requests and that kind of thing. We were doing it all on paper. And so they said, hey, Earl, could you write us a technical, like a PC support database that'll keep track of all of our work orders and our procurements and stuff like that. It took me months to do it, you know, kind of part-time while I was still doing the rest of the thing. But, it, you know, I did it and I thought, okay, we'll probably use this for a year or two. Turns out like 6 or 7 years later, they were still using that database to keep track of their work orders. It was amazing. This was, you know, late 80s into early 90s. One of the other cool pieces of software that I used was something called Jennifer with a G. G-E-N-I-F-E-R. And it was a database maker, I'll say. You would put in your parameters, like what you wanted the database to look like and what you wanted the update screens to look like. And it would go and it would produce all of the DBase 3 code to make it like you designed it. And then you could take that code and further modify it to meet your specific needs. You could put in some of the back-end logic. And that software was amazing. I actually got to, I went to a DBase 3 conference and I met the person who made that software. I was like, I don't know about other people, dude, but you saved my life. This software is just beautiful. I always love working with the databases too, all the way back to DBase 2, but onward. I thought those were great technologies. And then when the SQL world came along, I didn't really get on the bandwagon. That's where I kind of watched databases sail off into the sunset. And now I know how to work them. But it, you know, for a long time there, the database ship had sailed, and it sailed without me.
Yeah, it was mainly just for me getting into like web programming brought me back to databases.
Yep. Exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Forced me just when I thought I was out. They bring me back in.
Well, what do you think? Should we move on to listener feedback?
I suppose we could do that.
Sure. Do it.
So who's talking to us, Paul?
All right. Well, so we have a number of people who have sent things. So a lot of them are people mentioning things that we could talk about as topics. So,
which we appreciate.
Yes, we do appreciate that. I'm just thinking about this from a planning perspective. It means that I have... it's something like me having 15 items of interest in news, but maybe we can all comment upon them. So Charlie wrote over Twitter, and Bob actually wrote over email both to tell us about this self-contained tape loader for the ZX Spectrum.
I don't personally have a problem with you having 15 items of interest, by the way. We're all good with that.
It goes along with my eBay items.
Of interest.
Yeah. But anyway, so there's a write-up on Hackaday about this self-contained tape loader for the ZX Spectrum. It's a little thing that looks like a cassette, and you can put it into a cassette player. It's basically, I think it just mocks the magnetic information that comes on, you know, that is fed to the head. In fact, come to think of it, there used to be such things that you would plug into, like, your car stereo or whatever.
Yep. So, I was just thinking that. Exactly. That would fake out an audio stream. You plug it in and it would pretend to be a cassette.
Yeah. And so this is the purpose of this is to like send the, you know, computer programs across. But anyway, it seems pretty cool. I don't know that much about the project, but apparently there are you can get these for a number of systems. It's a Spectrum tape emulator related to the Ardwi tape. Let's see what the Ardwi tape is. I did look at this at one point. Yeah, you can get a bunch of different little boxes for they're basically like fake cassette players for the various systems. So they're in a little enclosure and they have plugs on them like a cassette player would, but they don't have a cassette in them.
Hmm. I dig it.
Yeah. Although, come to think of it, I'm not quite sure why an iPod can't do much of that same stuff. But
it's not as cool.
That's true. Anyway, so it's kind of a neat project. It makes you feel like you're still using, you know, at least with the cassette one, where it's actually built into the cassette shell. It makes you feel a little bit like you're still working with the tapes that you loved as a kid.
Yeah, being authentic. Hipster style.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll occasionally fail.
Well, yeah, that's an important part of it.
It's part of the charm.
Exactly. Chuck on Facebook wrote to mention that we talked about the mini pet from Tynemouth. Is it software? Really? I guess it is, even though this is all hardware. Basically, there was an early version of the mini pet that had some traces reversed on the user port, and so there's now an adapter. But if you have version 1.42 or 1.44 of the board, like so an early one, then you may need to get an adapter to map the pins to the correct ones.
I think they said they were sending out the adapter.
Oh,
if you
better.
If you requested, or I don't remember the exact details, but if you have one, yeah, check on their site on how they're handling that.
Yeah.
And I think the newer one, they actually revved the board so that the problem doesn't exist now on the new production boards. And this would have actually affected me, actually, if I would have bought one of these, because there is a new program out called PetTerm. Well, actually, it's been around for a while, but they just came out with an enhanced version. And it's something that I'm really interested in playing with, but it does require that you hook up a modem adapter or, you know, a serial adapter to your pet user port. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do something like that, then this would be important to you.
All right. Tony wrote on Facebook to point out that there's a Kickstarter for a Myst documentary. Have we talked about this before?
We have not, but I had noticed that as well. I thought there was a Myst documentary Kickstarter while ago. I kept thinking, is this the same thing again, or did that one not happen? I don't know. But it's 4 days to go, and it's almost funded, so it looks pretty close to its goal.
Yeah, it might be worth taking a look at. It's possible that by the time you're listening to this out in listener land, it will have ended, and we will know if it made it or not. But
so, question. Mm-hmm. There's the Myst demake, and now this documentary. Could somebody tell me, like in 20 words or less, about Myst? Because I missed mm-hmm. that particular
Oh, did you not
phenomenon.
Play the game when it came around?
Didn't. No.
Oh, it was a really, really terrific game. And speaking of HyperCard, it was a game actually created in HyperCard, the first version of it. So it's basically a point-and-click graphical adventure game with lots of puzzles, but the thing that kind of made it stand out at the time was a 3D rendered view. It wasn't like a walkthrough, but you were just looking at pictures of the scenes, but they were all 3D rendered, so it was really, really cool looking, had interesting puzzles, and also had embedded QuickTime movies. Those movies were, I think, like 160 by 120 pixel. Right. I mean, teeny little squares in the middle, like in an elevator and stuff for a guy looking through a book. But it just kind of caught the zeitgeist and it became super popular for age. I loved it. I played it and I loved it. I haven't played it for a million years, but I can see me going back to it someday.
Cool.
Hmm. Yeah. Really good game.
The graphics were all sort of pre-rendered by some, like, I think they had like a Cray or something that was doing these, you know, pre-rendered graphics scenes, and it had really good sound design. So
maybe the water, there'd be like sound when you're at a place, you'd hear the water playing basically from because you're on a little series of islands, and it was just like a almost like an Infocom game but graphical, so it was like lots of puzzles where you have to figure out, oh, if I get this item from there, I can use it this way to open a door. You're trying to solve a problem, like the overall story was kind of weird, like a you're uncle's caught in a book or something, or there's a bad guy too. That's my vague memory. Was like, two different guys, which book will you open? It's like, but it was actually a really good game. I would actually recommend it. It was, and there was subsequently, there were sequels to it, but then the original Myst game kept coming out in other versions. Like, here's real Myst, and there's one where you actually move, and there's one where it's better graphics, and one where it's all an interpretive dance or something. I don't know. So it's hard to know which version to play anymore. But it was a good game originally.
Yeah, the puzzles, there were a lot of different sorts of puzzles, but a lot of times they were, you know, like I think one that I kind of remember is there was some sort of like power grid, you know, like that you had to sort of power up, and each of the different switches would bring it up a certain amount, but like a differing amount. And if you went over the threshold, then it would all power down and reset. And so you had to sort of figure out like what combinations of these switches would add up to the amount of power you need. So it's just busy work, basically. Yeah. You know, you could take notes and try to figure it out and then, you know, eventually get there.
But most of the game, the feeling of the game was you were alone on this first one island and then a series of islands. So it's kind of like a walking simulator. So it's just like you in a mysterious place, walking around, interacting with some things in a kind of a puzzle way. And so it's as much about the atmosphere as the game, I think. So early walking simulator, early graphical puzzle game. Well, not that early, but still. Good game, though. I would recommend it, Earl. You should play it. We'll wait.
Yeah. All right. I'll be right back.
Okay.
No, you won't. It's a long game.
Daniel wrote on Twitter to say that he had a Dimension 68000 back in the early 80s.
Cool. We talked about that. Yeah.
And I think it was Blake who desperately wanted to get one. So Blake is not here to
fawn
over this. But anyway, Daniel says it was a fun machine and also a bit unwieldy. He mainly ran MicroProse Flight Sim on it and did a bit of 6502 coding in the Apple hardware card. That sounds interesting, actually. Also says that his uncle had something to do with the founding of the short-lived company, which I assume is the one that made the Dimension 68000 that he's talking about.
Very neat.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would be interesting to learn a little bit more about that. And maybe Blake can come back next time and tell us what all this means. Beej wrote on Twitter to just remind us that we spent, I think the last time we recorded an episode, we spent like the first half hour just talking about, you know, Apple's WWDC keynote, basically whatever it is, which we got a comment about on Twitter as well.
Very retro.
But one of the things that we lose with the transition to ARM, Beej reminds us, is not just virtualization of, you know, like running Windows in a window, but also just outright being able to boot into Linux and Windows, which you won't be able to do anymore on a Mac.
Let's discuss that for another half an hour.
Yeah, I think that sounds good.
That's a very good point from Beej, though.
Yeah.
Yes, and I would miss boot camp. I don't know, is it still boot camp with the current Macintoshes?
Yeah, if you're booting into the other thing, yes.
Yeah, because, you know, I would tell people one of the best Windows boxes ever was a Mac. Yeah. Because boot camp would load up all the drivers for you, would set everything all up, just boom, all of a sudden, you know, you're operational, and it was super smooth and very reliable. And so they're like, wait, a Mac to run Windows? I was like, yes. It is an excellent Windows box. So
it still can be if you don't need the neatest, the newest, that's what I want, the newest of everything, which according to this podcast, you don't. Like whatever, all the stuff is going to stay around. Screw the future, past is awesome.
That's right. Moving on to the next one. Bob wrote over email to point out, somebody did a project called IZCPM. Is CPM? I don't know. Which is basically, it's a way to run CPM stuff on modern hardware it's kind of in the Wine mindset, or it's kind of like, rather it's leveraging your computer's peripherals and power to run CPM rather than emulating it. It was written up on Hackaday, and there's a sort of a short thing about that. And then there's a GitHub has the, you know, that has all the installers for CPM 2.2 running on, say, your Mac or Linux machine. So if you want to do that, you can. There's an example of them running Zork, and I think other things. So
cool. The interesting thing is that even though there may be an architectural difference in the way they did the abstraction, I'm not mm-hmm. sure that for your typical user, there's going to be a practical difference. You still take this, you run it, it runs CPM. It'll probably feel like some of the CPM emulators that are out there. But it was pretty cool. I did light it up and try it myself.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, actually, what if you didn't care about the tech underneath, what difference it would make. It's true.
Right.
I mean, I guess possibly it might be slightly easier to map to your own directories, you know, on your hard drive or whatever. But that's actually always been a kind of an issue of trying to get in and out of getting mm-hmm. get files in and out of emulators.
That's true. Usually you've got to somehow figure out like there's a side utility to read and write files to a disk image or something mm-hmm. like that. It's kind of clunky. This might be better. I didn't try that with this. That's true.
Though one has to wonder what CPM would make of a like 1.8 gigabyte file.
Right. It would load it and overwrite the memory many times.
Right. Anyway, this is kind of cool. Peter wrote over email, but just had a question about Brian Bagnall's The Story of Commodore, A Company on the Edge book, wondering why it was so expensive. You can get it for $11 on a Kindle. But of course, you know, then you don't own it, and that's not great, and all that stuff. But apparently, wherever he was looking to find it, it was very expensive, and was wondering if it was somehow, you know, rare and precious or something. I don't know. I have it, but I bought it back when it was not rare and precious, I guess.
So I don't know the answer to this. I think I have the Kindle edition also, and was fine with that. I had the original in hardback, and then the price started to go up and up and up, so I sold it. And I don't quite know, you know, occasionally you'll see things with books like these, like, you know, they just get rare and you can't get them. And so all of a sudden the price skyrockets and you're just scratching your head. So I don't know what happened, but the newer version had some, as I recall, some enhanced materials, some extra stuff, and a couple corrections. Anyway, I don't know. Don't know. It's a mystery. So you say you don't own it on a Kindle. Is that true? Do you not own it? Are you just buying the rights to read it and those could go away? Or
is it not the case? I thought that there was something that happened with the Kindles. Like it might have, I forget what it was, but something got just removed from everybody's Kindle.
Oh, something disappeared, right? That's right. Yeah, I don't know.
But that's the kind of thing that I think Peter was worried about, is mm-hmm. that essentially it's DRM'd, and, you know, as long as you can read the DRM, you're okay.
There's mm-hmm. good software for, if you use a Mac, software I'm going to recommend called Calibre, C-A-L-I-B-R-E. And that's great for taking ebooks in one format and turning them into another format. And that format might be like one format full of DRM and another format with a lot less DRM. I run everything I purchase through that software. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I would prefer this piece, this file that is now a file that is mine.
Yeah.
So I recommend it. Free software works well. Ugly, ugly, ugly software, but it works pretty good.
And updated like every 4 days or something.
Yes. There is never not being updated when I've launched it. I think when you're in the DRM race, it's full-time job.
Yeah.
But it's also really great because if, like, let's say you switch things. Like, let's say you have a Kindle now, and then your next one is a Kobo. And it's like, oh, I don't want to use it. It's a great way to migrate your books to various devices and to keep a database of all your stuff and all copies of these files, which are actually quite small, on your computer. So I really like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not kept mine totally up to date, but it also, I think it can run a little server too, so that your phone can retrieve things from it, if you're not keeping things on your
that would be
actual
handy.
Phone. Yeah, it is really nice. It, I mean, like the un-DRMing part is also good, but that's not the only thing that it's good for.
No, I like it because to be able to go between formats and just keep my own copy of my whole library on my I just keep it on my computer, and then also everything's on my Kindle, but I have moved between the Kindle and the Kobo infrastructure mm-hmm. systems, whatever, mm-hmm. And might be moving again or whatever, and so I want to keep ownership of my stuff that I have purchased.
Yeah, for a while, every time I was getting something on the Kindle, I would as part of my process kind of run it through I have gotten behind.
I still do.
Is it Mac only?
I would assume not, because it does not look like a Mac app.
Exactly.
There's no way this thing is Mac. I think it runs, it's probably made Java or something. Like, there's no way this is a Mac first app.
Okay.
Yeah. It really does look, I mean.
Can't possibly be.
It looks very functional.
Yeah, very functional. That's the word for it. It's very functional.
Okay, let's see. Getting close here. Bill wrote over email just to point out, I guess we at some point had talked about clicky keyboards. And Bill wanted to point out that you can get keyboards. So PCKeyboard.com was the site that we were pointed to. I don't know what the relationship is between PCKeyboard.com and Unicomp. Maybe that is the same company. Maybe it is not. Maybe we are just giving someone an ad.
I was just going to ask you if it was Unicomp, if it's just another name for Unicomp, or if they're two separate companies.
Well, it does say in there under the About Us.
Yeah.
Unicomp's updated website.
Yep, it's Unicomp.
Okay.
There you go. And yes, they've been making them since back in the day.
So many, you know, buckling spring keyboards of various kinds.
Right.
USB. So they're not actually Model M's, but they're probably as loud.
You know, I saw one in person one time that looked very similar to the one that you had on the screen there. And it wasn't quite as loud, which, you know, I guess might be a good or a bad thing, depending on what you're looking for. But it did definitely have that buckling spring feel, the tactile kind of feel to the keys. It felt really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess if what you're after is to get, you know, people not to come into work.
Right. If you're out to annoy your cubicle neighbors, then it may not be the keyboard for you.
Right. Okay, and then the last thing I will mention is that Bob wrote over email to praise, in a way, the little plotter, the CGP-115 that we talked about. I think Carrington, wasn't it you who said that you had one of these?
And it was terrible, yes.
Yeah. So apparently this Tandy CGP-115 is the same as many other plotters that many other computers sort of packaged with them. So the Commodore 1520 and the Mattel Aquarius 4615.
It's the same as the 1020? The Atari 1020?
Which was the first printer I ever had, the little 1020 plotter.
Because there's been talk about that recently from the Antic guys, I think, trying to there's work on figuring a way to kind of recreate a replacement pen for it.
Yeah, okay. Well, in fact, it's possible that on Paul Rickard's site, this is now like 4 years ago, there's a discussion about fixing some of the gears that split in these. And I think Bob in the email actually mentioned something about the pens. I kind of had thought that the pens were discussed in this post here, but I don't see that. So maybe this is just about the gears.
Yeah, I feel like the pens are still available somehow in some weird way. And that problem with the gears, I think, is endemic to all of them, because the exact same discussion is for the Atari 1020 about how to replace those gears when they split apart.
Yeah.
So you had one back in the day, Jack. What'd you think of it?
It was great. You know, it was that tiny, narrow format, but it was really fun. It was sort of a, you know, when you output text to it, it took forever to draw, but it was really nice looking text. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, you know, it's like a vector arcade game instead of a pixel-based arcade game back in the day. You have these really nice, clear lines and, you know, diagonal lines with no jaggies, and just like it was fun.
So, you know, you can get variations on these for the different computer models for almost nothing. But if solutions come up with replacing the gears and creating the pens, I wonder if these are going to get more expensive all of a sudden. Because I'd love to have one just to play around with it. And looks like it doesn't take up much space either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now that I'm seeing this list, I'm wondering if I already have a couple. Because I'm pretty sure I have a Sharp C150, which is a thing in a different, you know, it's a different shape, but the same thing, basically. And I probably have the Mattel Aquarius printer, too. Interesting. All right. Oh, and in Bob's email, Bob said that he used it with an Osborne 1. Which was great for lab graphs, so that because specifically it was vector, and apparently the resolution was about 480 steps across the 4-inch paper and about twice that vertically. And there ends the feedback that I'd written down.
All right. Well, I guess then we'll go over to items of interest. And Carrington, you've got the first one.
Oh, I do. Then I will share a tab and let you know I've got three really quick game-related things. And the first is the game Worms Armageddon. Good game. Has just received an update. Its first update in 21 years. So version 3.8 is out. And I thought it was hilarious that it's a 21-year gap between updates. So there are some retro computers that are or retro games that are still going strong. Did any of you guys play this game back in the day? That day could have been yesterday, apparently.
I've never heard of it.
I mean, I think I remember playing like a Worms game a long, long time ago.
Okay, so Worms Armageddon is kind of like the ultimate of these, I think. Mm-hmm. I used to like the games like these back. Lemmings was another similar thing I liked back in the day. So I like these games. So anyway, Worms Armageddon has moved from 3.7 to 3.8 with a 21-year development cycle between them. So it is both retro and apparently an ongoing new development game. So
either they were working all this time and this update is really, really good.
or
something else.
Just found a bug. Yeah. I just thought it was hilarious that it's that long between things. So Worms Armageddon, now updated. You can play a game. It's actually a fun game. I would recommend it. It's hilarious that it was updated. So that's the first one.
Is this like, you know, Protoss 2.4 or whatever, where it's like someone else took it over and added something? Or is this the original company releasing an update?
That I don't know. I had assumed it was the original update, but it's just on a Worms. The link I've got is to the Worms knowledge base, which is like kind of about it. So I don't know. I'm going to say maybe.
Okay. Sounds good.
Do you know what this runs on?
No. Windows 10, definitely, and maybe earlier versions. I don't know.
Okay.
Linux, it says, and under Wine.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Right.
Cool.
That's what I get. So that's our first one. Worms Armageddon, 10 years. Now, if you prefer your games older than that, like super old, like thousands of years old, maybe you prefer chess, maybe you like chess on the Apple II, but you also want that super new experience. Well, this person has created an augmented reality chessboard linking to an Apple II, which is hilarious. So it's a video we're going to link to that I'm showing a bit on stream. So you can, it's got Sargon II on his Apple II, linked to the HoloLens 2, which is a virtual or augmented reality thing. So creates an augmented reality chessboard and you play on that board, but your opponent is just like when Earl and I played the two different computers. So the Sargon 2 on the Apple makes the move. So when you move a piece on the augmented reality chessboard, sends it over to the Apple 2, moves it there, Sargon replies, and then its move is done in augmented reality. So you get it like a physical chessboard, but it's actually powered by the Apple II. So there's a really nice combination of super old and super new and well implemented. Did any of you guys see this video before?
I hadn't. That's really cool.
That's pretty
isn't
fun.
It? Like I thought it was, and then the video shows the game, but then goes through the whole thing about like, how is it done? And I would recommend it. Like it's cool. It's a very neat thing. So that's my second one, and while it's neat, it is not nearly as neat and jaw-dropping as my third one. So, which is another video, which we're going to switch to in a second because it'll explode your brain when I show you. So we have to describe it first. You can look at chess, try to stay calm while I describe this next thing. We've often talked about how the game that people always ask, will it run it? Will it run Doom? Will it run Doom? Oh, we've got this new thing. It's really tiny. It's my fridge. Will it run Doom? What will run Doom? Well, somebody noticed that Windows Task Manager, an interesting thing about that is it will bring up a little grid showing you each of your CPUs and how much work is being done on them. And if you have enough CPUs, let's say you've got more than 800 CPUs and you make just a grid of those on the screen, you can think of those like pixels. So what if you wrote software that just worked various CPUs to various levels of amounts of work and then did that in such a way that the CPUs display a game of Doom? But the game is being played using full CPUs, just working them hard or not hard to make the Windows Task Manager light them up more or less in dark, and it creates an entire Doom game you play on 896 cores using each core as a pixel.
So first off, who has 896 cores in their system?
Not me.
Yeah, I wonder about where, like what Are they? Maybe they are actually virtual cores, but I don't even know what that means.
But it's secondly, insanity. How would you think this up? This is genius.
And then to do it in a way that you so fast. So I need this pixel here to be relatively dark or not dark. And you're not doing a shader. You're not doing ray tracing. You say, I'm just going to work CPU number 645 to 86% of its ability, and that will give me the right shade of draw. And do that fast enough that you have a Doom game in this many pixels. I've never seen anything like it. It was just crazy.
That is absolutely bizarre.
So, yeah, it's bonkers. I'm like, what the heck, man? So, will it run Doom? Yes. Yeah, even this is like the Doom running the Doom of all the Dooms. So, sort of retro and also just sort of insane. And so those are my three quick game updates.
Cool. On the chess one, that is the same person who did Kansas Fest, Hackfest entry, where having like two Sargon players, two Sargon computers play each other, too, by the way. The person who made the VR or the augmented reality chess.
Cool.
So.
Well, you're right. Mind blown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm totally mesmerized.
how does one do this? This is crazy. So we'll have a link in the show notes. People, you really should go look at the video. It's shocking. It's hard to even get your head around how it's doing this. So there you go. Plays Doom.
I think the next level thing you should do is hook this up to an array of floppy drives so that the music is being played by the motors.
Or you could have individual people playing Doom on a single core machine. You have to tell them you have to work your game of Doom such that it makes the anyway, it's crazy. So it's a Windows Task Manager being used as a display.
Wow.
Yep. That's what I got.
All right. Well, I can't top that, but I've got the next item, and it's another retro podcast, which is great. Another podcast joins the ranks. This one is called This Week in Retro, and it's featuring Neil, a.k.a. Retro Man Cave, and John Schaller. And I love the Retro Man Cave YouTube channel. Just think it's great. So was really excited that this podcast was being launched. Listen to episode one. They cover retro gaming and retro computing both. And there's an interesting twist on this one. They have a Reddit, and they actually take votes for the topics that will be discussed on the next episode. So I thought that was a fun twist, too. We'll have a link to it up in the show notes. Like I say, I listened to episode one, really liked it, and excited to see it go forward.
Cool.
That voting thing has got to get hacked at some point. People say, let's just vote the same thing every week. We're just like desert bus these guys. Just, yep, no, same topic again. Go deeper. It's going to be great.
200 million votes for Spectrum? I don't
yep,
think
again.
So.
That's cool. That's very good. Speaking of finding podcasts in our chat, John McDougald, Dougland, sorry, Dougald? John recently found a podcast. Hey, Alexa. Hello, John. And then he also recently discovered RetroBits. Yeah. Earl, don't scare John off.
I'll do my best. All right, Jack, you've got one here about a company called, I don't know how to pronounce that. Help me out.
I think it's called Durgod. So Durgod, they make keyboards. I don't know what else they do, but they've been making keyboards for a while. And they have one that's on a Kickstarter right now called the Durgod Fusion. And it's a modern mechanical keyboard with Cherry MX switches. You can get to pick which kind you want. Connects with Bluetooth or with USB cord or with a traditional wireless dongle that many keyboards have. But the nice thing about this is that they made it in they had a sort of a retro style to it. So there are three different color combinations that are designed to bring to mind different systems of the past. So like there's one that is the original, which is kind of like it's got some beige, some gray, a little bit of orange. Reminds me of the old Atari 400, actually. Fortunately, not the membrane, though. They have one called the Steam, which is basically NES colors. Like it's got this kind of like a couple different shades of gray and red there. And then there's one called the Navigator, which is like dark blue and white, which I guess someone said this looks maybe like the BBC Micro had kind of a bit of this kind of coloration to it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it looks like a pretty nice thing. It's got a nice sort of chunky design to it that I think looks pretty great. The Kickstarter is on right now until I think it's only for another couple of weeks.
But it's been very funded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it is very, very funded.
Yeah, 317,000 out of the 13,000 milligrams.
But if you join the Kickstarter, you get it. You get it for like a half price. So I think right now it's about $100, and after this, it'll be $200 because they're saying it's half price. So I think it looks pretty sweet. I've actually ordered one of these. I'm looking forward to getting it someday, whenever that is.
I love that styling. I like the white and gray and orange one the best. Yeah. The original flavor.
Yep.
And it looks like they're using Cherry MX switches. Great choice.
Yeah, you can pick which Cherry MX switches you want.
Whichever.
They have the full gamut of.
It looks small with the photos of the hands, but then there's like a little GIF of like a girl sitting there typing it, and maybe she's just tiny because then it looks full size with her.
It is a full size keyboard. It's what they call a 65% keyboard because it does not have the numeric keypad on the side.
Hmm. Okay, and there's a picture of it beside a 50 inch MacBook Pro, and it's basically the same width of that. Okay, yeah, so then that's decent size. Okay.
Yep. So this looks like a lot of fun to me. I'm like I said, I've ordered this. I'll get it when I get it, and I'll let you guys know. But
you'll get it if you get it.
Yeah, I think it seems very. I like the sort of versatility also that it does. Have a wired connection and Bluetooth and the dongles. You can sort of pick what you want to do.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it'll work which means it'll also work with iOS devices or anything else that uses Bluetooth. So I'm pretty pumped about this. Just wanted to share it with y'all.
So you say it's $100 for the Kickstarter, but it'll be more like double that after the Kickstarter?
I think that is what they've said.
Okay. Well, if you want one, better get it. When's the Kickstarter end?
It ends in, I think, 2 weeks, 15 days to go.
Okay.
So,
do you know if there's key options? Like, can you get one with a Windows key or with a command key for Mac, that sort of thing?
That I don't know. I did see that it ships with like a little key removal tool and stuff. I don't know if it comes with extras like the Mac command key. That would be nice. But that I just don't know.
Just to keep filling out the bingo card. The Steam one, the one that's called Steam, looks like a PX8 keyboard.
So, what is the PX8?
The Epson PX8. The
it Geneva. Does have that okay. Reminiscent color.
Have you never mentioned it before?
I think on the last time we recorded, the hypothesis was that we have now talked about it more often on more episodes than there are machines.
Right. Almost certainly. Certainly, it is the case that my girlfriend, who's totally real and lives in Canada, she's sick of hearing.
That's right. All right. Well, in the next news item, I guess that is, Inception inspired. It looks like we've got OS 8 on JavaScript. Wow.
Yeah. So this is the Macintosh.js. Project, and it's essentially it's an Electron version of Mac OS 8. It says it's basically an app you can download. What it's done is it's translated I guess it must be Basilisk into JavaScript and then runs it in an app. So it's pretty cool. I mean, it's basically I don't know if to what extent people have tried to run Sheepshaver or Basilisk to do old Mac things. But they're sometimes mildly painful to configure and to get it working properly and stuff. And so the kind of cool thing about this is it's just like a launchable app. It connects to your file system, so you can just drag things in and out of it. But it actually comes with some stuff already installed. So there are some games, Oregon Trail and Duke Nukem demo and Civilization 2 demo. I'm having trouble actually getting the double clicking to work. But at any rate, but it does run. It's just like, a little Mac in a window, which is pretty fun, actually. And as I say, it's much less painful than trying to get Basilisk 2 running. And it's also amazing that it's just running in JavaScript in an Electron app.
Yep.
So, cool.
That's about it, though. Oh, well, actually, no, that's not about it. I was reminded, actually, of this old web dot today. I don't know if we've talked about this. This is not new, I don't think. But it's basically seeing the emulator just sort of start in JavaScript like that reminded me of this, that you basically, at old web dot today, you can pick a browser that you want to emulate. So Windows, Macintosh, or Linux for NCSA Mosaic, at least. They have various versions of Netscape, various versions of Internet Explorer. And so you pick the browser, you pick an address and a date, and it will sort of go mine like the Wayback Machine or a number of other possible archives and like let you run the web as it was at that time. It's super interesting. I think there are only sort of like some small number of users available at a time. So
this is crazy.
Yeah.
I just went on and said, okay, I want like 1999. Go to apple.com, use Netscape Navigator 4.8 on the Mac, and it like boots an instance of the Mac OS.
Yep.
And then launched Netscape Navigator and then went to apple.com, and now I'm looking at it. That's crazy.
And what's also, you know, it's sort of nostalgic in a kind of way. You get to see the individual images load one after the other for 3 minutes. it's pretty fun to play with, but unfortunately it is resource limited. So you have to be...
Oh, I guess I was using up one of those slots where I was immediately on this thing, like, this is great!
Yeah. So now it finally actually let me on, probably because Carrington finished. And
yep, I closed when I realized I was grabbing a slot.
There's a time left, but it really, it's basically doing the same thing as that Electron app was. It's just sort of like running a whole Mac in the browser and then retrieving the data from the site that you asked for. And it has, you know, whatever archive.org has. Yeah.
And the fun thing, like often I'll, you know, you go to the Wayback Machine and archive.org, but that's not the same as saying, I want to browse that old site. I want to go to CNN.com on this date using this for Windows or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's a much different retro experience. Very cool find. I don't think we've discussed that before. I think that at least is new for me.
Okay.
I hadn't heard of it before.
Neat.
That's awesome.
That's quite cool.
Well, I think I've got the next one. And this came to us both from Spectron on Twitter and Bob via email. So thank both of you for that news item. So there is a website, glenstuff.com, and Glenn makes cool recreations of old computers. He did the PET 2001, and now he's made a TRS-80 Model 1. And he looked at the functionality of those machines, which were fairly simple, mostly made from off-the-shelf parts, and created a clone of them, but did the engineering so that the clone uses all modern-day, currently available parts, but still simplistic circuits. It doesn't use an FPGA. It doesn't use complicated systems. It uses more simple chips, and it's a functional clone. So you can look at the YouTube video for his TRS-80 Model 1 clone, and you can see he can switch between level 1 and level 2 basic. He can load in a cassette program through the audio connection. He has rigged up a PS2 keyboard adapter that not only works with the clone that he built, but apparently will work with a real Model 1. If you want to use a PS2 keyboard on an actual Model 1, you just plug in the ribbon cable and off you go. So a couple things. If this is interesting to you at all, check out the link in our show notes because I think it's fascinating. The write-up that he did, the PDF, is I think almost 50 pages, and I'm partway through it and just amazed at the engineering chops that Glenn has to do something like this. Plus, I want to know where or how he fabricates the front panel for these, because the front panel that he made for the PET clone and the one for the TRS-80 Model 1 clone both have this beautiful, old-style, almost rack-mount kind of industrial design, but the etching and the drilling, anyway, however these were fabricated, they're just gorgeous looking. So cool. So that's that. And, you know, if you want to, you could build one because he's got the PCB board files that you can use. He's got a bill of materials for both of the clones that he made. I don't know how in the world you'd build a beautiful case like that, but it's something that I would like to find out more about. Very exciting project. And, you know, one of the things about retro computers that always makes me a little nervous is you stick them in the closet, and then when you take them out again, you don't know if you got bit by closet rot. Are they going to actually turn on and work, or is something, has something gone haywire, right? Since you put
that's part of the excitement.
Right? That's right. It's, you know, edge of your seat kind of thing, which I like and I don't like. So something with modern components, but an exact functional clone is just so super exciting to me. I think it's a great project and you should go take a look at these.
If it was an exact functional clone, it should have a little thing that puffs out the smell of a burning cat, though.
Yeah.
You want to really make it a proper clone.
And for a Model 1, it should have the expansion chassis, you know, disconnect randomly on you.
Right.
All right. So that's that one. Jack, you've got something on Fujinet, which I think is a super duper project, and they're making great progress. It's like at a almost at a milestone, right?
Yeah, I would say so. So we've been talking about this a number of times. Fujinet is it's now a multifunctional device for the Atari 8-bit computers. It started off as basically a sort of Wi-Fi modem adapter, which we've talked about many times. But since Atari doesn't have a straight RS-232 serial port, it has the SAO port, which is actually much more capable. So what they've done is build in more things into this. So basically, apart from you can do the Wi-Fi modem stuff, but they've also built in things like a network drive emulator. So you can have files hosted on a computer on your on another machine somewhere, and the Atari will think that's a floppy, and I'll boot from it. And so lately what they've done is they have shipped out a few dozen of these during the summer to people who are interested in getting one. I didn't get one yet. By the time I saw the announcement of it, I had already missed the boat, but I'm on the list for future notices, I hope. And so what it does is it basically it exposes on the Atari what's built into the Atari. You have kind of – well, you have device drivers basically. And so this exposes some drivers. So it exposes a disk driver, which mounts as D. It exposes an R, which is the serial driver normally. This is if you're going to use a modem software of some kind to call a BBS, you'd use the R, which then does this the normal sort of Wi-Fi modem stuff. But there also it also does printer emulation. So it emulates a whole bunch of standard Atari and other printers, including the 1020 plotter. And so it emulates these by then printing. If you print to any one of these devices, it generates a PDF, saves it. Seems pretty neat. Cool. They've also created a new device called N for network, which has not existed on Atari before. But I think they have a proof of concept of some kind of like a chess game or something. So you can connect an N device with somebody else across a network and play this game. There are things like a text speech converter based on SAM, which is the old classic Stephen Hawking voice type of thing. That'll all be built into it. And so there's more they're working on, but what they've done during the summer is finalized or frozen like the version 1.0 of the hardware, which they say they will also release on GitHub by the end of August, they say. Yeah, so I think it's looking really exciting. I'm looking forward to getting one of these when I can, and we're linking to a site. It's fujinet.online. There you'll find links to their GitHub repository and their Discord chat and a number of videos on YouTube. So Thomas Cherry Holmes is one of the main guys working on this. He has produced quite a number of videos that are on YouTube describing how this works, showing off the feature set. And he's been doing that for a long time. So it's been fun. I've been watching those. I haven't watched all of them, but I dip in sporadically and take a look. And it's been fun to see what's going on. So here's a bit of emulating an Atari thermal printer that was available called the 822, which was also a narrow mode sort of thing. Anyway, there's a lot to like about this. I'm quite excited about this, actually.
Yeah, this is wild.
It seems like this is kind of like, you know, the SIO to PC concept reimagined.
Right.
With the SIO to PC, you had some of that functionality, like a virtual drive and a virtual modem, but you had to have some sort of outboard computer that was doing those right. things for you, right? Whereas this is just all the device wrapped up into one, plugs into the SIO port, and has more than the older style device ever did. So this is just right. so yeah. cool.
And you can also put in, they currently have an SD card slot, so you can also just put files on there to mount locally as disk images. Things like the printer emulation, I don't know, but I assume that it can actually just save those PDFs right on the SD card as well. Mm. But I don't know that for a fact. But it's pretty interesting. There's a lot going on the website. There's a link to a shop where you can sort of look at things, but you can't actually order anything because the add to cart is grayed out.
Well, and if they hit the price point that they were originally targeting, that's going to be really exciting too, because it's right. just not expensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're talking about well under $100. I think it was, I don't know. Well, here it says 65. Mm-hmm. Whether it sticks with that or not, we will see. But
anything in that ballpark is just what a deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really great for the price. So that's the status of that.
Very cool. All right. Well, now a word from our sponsor.
When Lotus introduced 123 software, it became the talk of the business world. And 123 quickly took its rightful place at the top of the PC software sales charts. But people said,
Lotus, what are you doing for an encore?
Lotus announces Symphony. 123 and new Symphony software from Lotus. One great idea after another.
And we're back. All right. Let's talk about things that you guys can buy for me. So here's one. The Altair Duino. I've kind of got Altair on the brain lately, and I'll explain that in a little bit. But this project just looks so stinking cool. And I've seen some YouTube videos on people doing a build on this. You take an Arduino and you turn it into an Altair. And there is a neat little case that goes around it with all the switches and the LEDs and the front panel kind of reproduction. It's smaller than an Altair. It's way shorter than an Altair, but it functions like an Altair. And it's also pretty reasonably priced. You can get the standard edition of this for $150. Or you can get the Pro version, which adds a couple things, including a VT100 built-in terminal kind of functionality with a PS2 keyboard and VGA out. And that is $250. Like I said, an Arduino is its brain. And it has the look and feel. You can play with the toggle switches. Just, you know, fun for the whole family. So have you guys seen this? What do you think of this?
It's pretty cool. I think the last episode had an eBay auction for like a spare one that the producer of these had around. So I like this because I think it would be cool to have a 8800 emulator, but I don't really want, I mean, they're too big.
Yeah.
So yes. Something this size is about exactly right. Actually, I mean, the Pro one is deeper. You know, it has a deeper case than the non-Pro one, the standard one.
Yeah, and, the standard one is almost in what looks like an acrylic frame sort mm-hmm. of thing. And you're right, it's very shallow, whereas the Pro one is a little bit more of a box that sits on your desk. And the colors are Altair colors, and it just looks gorgeous to me. And the YouTube videos that I've seen, it looks like the actual build process for it goes fairly smooth also. And I put one of those YouTube videos in the show notes.
Cool.
Yeah. It is kind of nice looking. Maybe I'm changing my mind about the Pro one.
Yeah, it'd be a fun project to build. Well, why don't we talk about other things we can buy? Carrington, what can we buy?
Oh, am I first? Okay, so I've got three things. I'm going to pitch you guys, mostly Paul, because I'm always trying to get Paul to buy things. I'm going to pitch you on Ultimate 80s Lifestyles in three different countries. So I picked America first. I'm changing my choice. Originally, it was going to be a film house. Turns out I picked the exact same listing we had talked about a while ago. So that's dead to me. New choice. We have to imagine it's America in the 1980s, and you're awesome. You have an awesome corporate job. You're selling stocks to losers. You were in the inspiration behind the whole ad campaign for the Coffee Achievers, and you think Less Than Zero is an aspirational book. If this is the lifestyle you want, then the product you need is a PowerBook car adapter, because now you can not only work at home and work at work, you can work while you're en route between the two of them. Maximum efficiency, perfect for a go-go lifestyle, just like cocaine, the ultimate 80s vitamin for America. And so this is my first choice. These are not super rare, but this one is still sealed in box, and it's the applied engineering one, and it's for the old school PowerBooks, so the 140 to the 180C. Really good period. I had a 165, I think, that I liked very much, and I could have had a cocaine addiction and also worked to and from things if I wanted that ultimate American lifestyle. So it's still sealed, less than $35. Buy it now. I think that's a good deal for this. Paul,
so it's,
can I convince you in the ultimate 80s American lifestyle?
So it says portable cigarette lighter adapter for the Macintosh PowerBook, which, I mean, like, is that even what they're called anymore?
Like, no, it's just 12 volts, so it'll run your PowerBook off a 12 volt source. Yep. Which you can also get a lot of generators that have that plug in, you know, 12 volt DC adapter, and this would work off those. So this would also be a way to go camping with a PowerBook, or take one of those generators down to the beach and show up those Apple IIc people. Say, I've also got a beach computer here with my pull start generator, and I'm using my PowerBook 140. It's the ultimate way to go.
Yeah.
Since the batteries in those things are all dead nowadays, this would be a great way to run one on the beach.
Nice.
Ultimate 80s cocaine-fueled lifestyle. So that's my first item. If for some reason I cannot convince you guys to go ultimate 80s, then we're going to go ultimate USSR. So now instead, we're going to imagine it's the 1980s, but this time you're in the USSR, land of black market blue jeans and big red propaganda posters. You love to stand in endless lines for bread or toilet paper. Seem familiar. And you love to be in the endless third year of the latest five-year plan. And most importantly, you enjoy both the music and, this is vital, the timeless fashion sense of Sig Sig Sputnik. If this is the lifestyle that you want, then my next eBay choice is the computer for you. It's the Soviet Byte ZX Spectrum. It's a clone. Looks like an IBM Model M keyboard, but it's not a Model M compatible. It is, in fact, a ZX Spectrum that's not even really ZX Spectrum compatible, which is truly the Soviet way of looking. So it is, because it's missing that, there's that chip that goes in the Spectrums to make it a Spectrum. The whole point of the Spectrum is they got that chip. It doesn't have that. So imagine a Spectrum without that sweet Spectrum sauce. But if you want that ultimate Soviet computing, I think the idea of a computer that's kind of a Spectrum that doesn't actually run Spectrum stuff is awesome. It's made by a company called Brest, because of course it is. Yeah. I mean, come on. This is my ultimate Soviet thing. And it's still in box. So if you're a collector of like weird ZX Spectrum clones, then this is probably actually a cool one to have. So $189, buy it now. Still in box with all its Russian goodness. I looked it up, and this originally sold for over ₹1 million, which is about $350. So you're actually getting a bargain for your ultimate 80s USSR black market lifestyle.
The cool thing about this is that if you found one of these or brought it to Goodwill or whatever, they'd just think it was a keyboard. I mean, like, there's almost nothing here that looks at all like a computer.
It just is keyboard. It's in a box, and it's a keyboard.
Mm-hmm. And it also has two rows of identical arrow keys. I'm not sure why you would, like, why what the left up and the right up do differently.
Just in case.
It's so you can arrow up twice as fast by pressing both keys at once.
Perhaps, yeah.
And if you just like track and field style, hitting those buttons, up really fast.
That is kind of strange. I didn't even notice that. But there's also, so the arrow keys next to the space bar, and there's arrow keys the right. So there's three different ways to go up or down or left and right, spread variously around. It's the Russian way. In Russia, arrows move you. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that is my ultimate USSR lifestyle choice. But third choice, if those aren't the countries you want to live in, perhaps you want to go to the UK instead. And so my ultimate 80s UK lifestyle, this is going to be now the land of punk rock and Maggie Thatcher, two things that I personally very much associate with the apocalypse. if you want a lifestyle filled with striking miners and deregulated banks and mass unemployment, all set to the soundtrack of the synthiest synth pop that ever popped a synth, then I have the ultimate 80s in British computers. It is a brand new old stock BBC Acorn. It is a kit, but more importantly, it's a kit designed for export, which is something I hadn't seen before. I didn't even know this was a thing. So it's not to run on, it's like runs on 120. And so this is a kit that you can take to North America. And I think, what, dear listener, could possibly be more British than a colonizing computer? So this is a computer designed to go out to the colonies and bring the Acorn to the masses. And I think it's pretty cool. So I didn't even know that this was a thing. And so this is my last choice. It's $1,000. So somebody else thinks it's pretty rare. Mm-hmm. And it can switch between 115 or 230 volts.
That's really cool. I didn't know these things existed in a kit. I've been searching for a North American one ever since I was in junior high.
You want to drop $1,000 on this one?
Yeah.
It ain't cheap, but it's a still new inbox kit designed to go. I didn't know this was a thing. Like, I don't know. It was totally bizarre to me. So I see this colonizing computer as the ultimate in 1980s British UK lifestyle. So these are the three lifestyles I have to offer Paul.
So the thing about this,
turns out he's going to buy this one.
The thing about this one is that not only, you know, so it's made to be built for North America, but I mean, like, the problem is that if I'm building it, it's also not going to work.
So could be a problem.
Yeah. It's $1,000, but is there a make offer? I didn't see.
There is.
Let us see. There is.
Excellent.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure I've mentioned this probably every time the BBC Micro comes up, but when I was in, I think it was late junior high, my school had a BBC Micro, and I took it home for the summer. So I had a chance to play with it. There was no disk drive, so everything all the programs that I wrote on it, disappeared when the power went away.
Like tears in rain.
Yeah. But I liked it. You know, the color scheme was cool. It was also a 6502 machine, so I kind of knew how to talk to it. I could leverage my Apple knowledge on it. I would love to find them, find one, but, they're all in the UK. I mean, like, since that time, I've never seen one in North America. I just know that they existed because I had one and plugged it in with a normal looking plug to me.
Right. Well, this is how they came.
Yeah.
And for the low, low price of $1,000, or you make an offer that involves tea and then you can get it. But yeah, I hadn't seen it before. I hadn't seen it as a kit. I certainly hadn't seen it as an export kit.
Yeah.
So those are my three choices. Three countries, three lifestyles, 80s. Go.
Excellent. Nice. I think as the RCR host for this episode, I'm required by statute to point out RCR does not encourage you to time travel to the 80s and ingest prohibited substances.
Yes. That's
right. I don't know if cocaine was prohibited in the 80s. I think it was required.
That's right.
From the movies, it seems to be just like everywhere. But I don't know. I was a kid. I didn't understand. I don't even think I was sure what it was, to be honest. You'd hear these words. I'm like, yeah, I know what that is. I did not know what that was. I was pretty sheltered. I still might not know what it is.
All right. Well, mine is next and doesn't involve any of the above. But I thought that this was actually not a bad deal. This is a TRS-80 Model 4P for portable. And I love these things. It's interesting. It's a version of the Model 4 that you could pick up like a luggable and take along with you. I've always been fascinated. Never seen one in person. This one looks like it's in decent cosmetic shape. And also, at least it has some sign of life. The person who's selling it doesn't have the diskettes. So the only thing that they could get when they turn it on is just something saying, hey, feed me a floppy. But they don't have a floppy, so they can't. The floppies might work. They might not work. Who knows? But, you know, for $100 at a starting bid, it didn't seem like a bad deal. And I just thought this 4P was always so interesting looking. I mean, it's just a very generic looking white box. And the keyboard almost has the styling of something like a Tandy 1000. Doesn't it kind of have that same sort of look? So that's my pick. $100 mm-hmm. or
the weirdest placement for the caps lock key to the right of the space bar.
Oh yeah, look at that.
That is strange.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
The 2GS used to have a bottom left corner of the keyboard. I used to really like that placement. I don't think I've ever seen a keyboard with it to the right of the keyboard or right of the spacebar. That's an odd placement for that.
Yeah, the whole keyboard kind of looks like it was sort of tipped up to the side and like the keys kind of jumbled down off to the lower right.
Like you shake it on the left and see which keys hang on.
This one is not, it's surprisingly unyellowed. I mean,
right.
I've seen many of these.
Oh, but is it? See, yeah.
Oh,
you never
camera.
Know with photos. Like this is against this brown right. and all that background. I think the white balance on this photo is way off and I'd want to see something white against it. I think it's much more yellow than you think. Photos are tricky that
but
way.
But it has yeah. the book, Carrington. It's also got the book.
Yep.
Yeah, but it doesn't show the book leaning up against the computer.
Oh, yeah,
put yes, it together. True. I want to see a white card in there.
So
baby.
It's supposed to look the same color as the book.
It does not.
Yeah. But this is my only TRS-80. I have one of these, and it's.
Oh, really? You've got
oh,
one
you
of these?
Do. Yeah. Does it work?
It does the same thing as this one. You know, it says in German, "Please put in a disc."
Oh.
Are you? Is it 3,000 pounds? I've always thought these things must be so heavy. They look it's super
not,
solid.
I don't really remember. It's not ridiculously heavy. I think the IBM PC portable is heavier.
Does it say put in a disk because you don't have a disk? Or does it say that because you do have a disk and the floppy drive doesn't work?
Well, I think it just says that if it fails to boot. So probably both of those cases.
More to the point, is this person selling your computer?
Yeah.
Have you seen yours in a while?
Unfortunately, I haven't because it's not been right in my office. But
exactly.
But it's kind of cool. The keyboard slides in this little space under the screen, and then the whole thing closes up. I kind of wanted to have a TRS-80, but I didn't want to devote a desk space to like a Model 4 or 3 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this can just sit on the shelf. I kind of like it. You can get... Did I buy one? I forget now. But you can get it. There's a couple of sort of like hard drive solutions you can get for these. Like the Mize or M3SE or something, I think, works on these. And there's another one, which I think, and I think the other one is the one I bought, but I can't remember the name of it. Dr. Ian. What is his name? I don't know. One of the guys from the, who's actually on one of the other TRS-80 podcasts.
The Trash Talk. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sells them. So. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the one that I got. A project for the future.
Well, speaking of that, you have some eBay picks that might be projects for your future.
Yes. Okay. As usual, I wrote down everything that I saw, and so I don't know that I want to do every one of them. Some of them are just sort of interesting in their existence. The first one is just, I'll just mention this because I always thought it was kind of interesting to see these in their original packaging and stuff. But this is a Hayes Micromodem 2, which is a very popular modem for the Apple II. They existed actually in a number of different computers. I think they existed also for like S100 computers. So, and this is basically just the whole box. It's got the manual and the outer casing and the styrofoam and the card and the cables. And one of the things that is sort of is notable, I suppose, about the Micromodem is that it actually comes in two pieces. So there's a micro coupler piece that sits outside the computer and connects to the phone line. And so if you have just the card, that is not sufficient. You need also the micro coupler to get connected to the wall. And I think that was for some sort of regulation thing. I mean, like the phone company wanted, there was something that they needed to do with this box to get it to be allowed by the phone company.
So, oh, remember those times? Okay.
Yeah. And also the coupler, I think the coupler works with the S100 ones too. I mean, like that's kind of like a part in common.
That thing is off the hook.
Glad I could provide a platform for your puns.
We've only just begun.
This one is a vintage Apple Newton fax modem, which I thought was just a delight of obsolescence. So
so many things obsolete in one auction. Well done.
It's only $9, though. So, I mean, if you want it.
And technically, faxes still exist, much as I railed against them since the 80s.
Yeah.
You can actually still use this. You could fax somebody.
Yep. If you had a Newton.
If you had a Newton.
And the phone line.
If we had some eggs, we could have ham and eggs if we had some ham.
That's right. on the Newton theme, I thought this was sort of interesting. This is a Newton message pad 2100 and all the stuff auction. And this one is basically going for whatever the market allows.
Nice.
So it started off at a cent, and it is currently at $41. But it's nice. It's like the last of the handheld Newtons. It has mm-hmm. a keyboard. It has some of the Wi-Fi cards and things. So it's probably about as modern as you can get in the Newton world, mm-hmm. short of maybe the E-Mate. So anyway, kind of cool. Neat. Okay, here is the PX8 keyboard. If you didn't want to get one that works on the
wait a minute, that's a new old stock replacement.
It is. Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it just one, or do they have a few?
I think it's just one. And it is, this one also is going for the market, whatever the market will bear. So this is currently has one bid, and it is
whatever
99
Earl
cents.
Will bid
I
for.
Might
yeah.
actually put in a bid on this just yeah. to have it, because I've got
let's watch you do it live.
I got a couple PX8s. It might be nice to have a spare keyboard handy.
Yeah. This actually is more colorful than I remembered. So
they are. They're really neat yeah. looking.
Okay, what's next? More Epson.
Oh, the HX20
yeah.
with its little built-in cassette player.
So this one is the keyboard that looks a little bit more like that, the one we were talking about earlier. The what was it?
The Durgod, yeah.
Yes, right. So this, what I thought was kind of cool about this is that you can actually find HX20s fairly easily on eBay. This has an expansion unit on it, so it's sort of attached to the edge. So actually, this is kind of interesting. The expansion unit has this, it's like a bracket that you screw in.
It's like bolted
yeah,
to it.
Yeah. It is very oh secure. That yeah. I've got one of these with the expansion unit, and that bracket is like it, you could probably stand on it. I wouldn't, but I'm saying it's probably
challenging.
So whatever, it looks kind of nice. But the thing is, so there were these cases.
I was gonna say I like this case.
Yeah, they're you know it's designed for it, but it also comes with like a bunch of extra printer ribbons, and I don't know what these other things are. Some cassettes and the cables and things like that. It has manuals. They actually look like library bound.
Wow. I like this software. One's like a personal productivity software, but mm-hmm. I like this one that's a warm-up kit for your enjoyment while learning to use the yeah. HX20 notebook computer. So I wonder what the heck's on that.
I am curious about that. Earl, do you know?
I do not know.
That was the HX20 was kind of out of your time frame, right?
Well, I mean, we still sold them. We still support them, but I didn't get many calls on them.
Hmm. I don't think I've ever seen this, like these manuals and the tape and, like, you know, it has all the
I've
all
got
the
those
stuff.
Blue-bound manuals, but mm-hmm. I didn't have that other one I've never seen. It looks really nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's HX20 technical manual. That's probably actually somewhat rare. Oh, and look at that. There's a case mm-hmm. inside. This is
this is really a
I like
complete
leather
auction.
Pouch.
Yeah. So it's so far a starting bid of $151, which is I'm starting to think not terrible.
Mm-hmm. Paul's going to buy it.
Yeah.
That's how it begins.
Add to watch list. Okay. what's next? Oh yeah, this is the in the show notes I listed this as you know because Carrington likes to get bags to make friends, and I thought this would be.
I do. It doesn't work, but I do. Always, I'm hopeful someday.
So this is the shopping bag for encouraging social distancing. It is a WordPerfect 8 bag.
That's hilarious.
Actually, to be honest, I thought of the joke first and then searched around for the least likable bag.
That's hilarious.
Anyway.
Oh, man.
It's also an ugly bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, of course WordPerfect would put out like a super hideous bag.
Yeah, it's just like it's not, they didn't put the logo on the bag. They put a picture of the box on yeah. the bag.
In black and white.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, it can be yours for $15.
That's awesome.
Okay.
Wait, they pay you $15?
Exactly.
Not enough.
I thought this was kind of interesting. I think we've talked a little bit about the microprocessor before, but this is a microprocessor one. It is, I think it's a Z80 machine. But it's basically, it's supposed to be like just a little like learning to use computers machine. So it's in the shape, it's sort of enclosed in this thing that looks like a book. And on one side, it's got sort of a single board computer looking thing with a keyboard on it, and it has a little display. This is the microprocessor 1P, 1 plus, MPF 1 plus. And on the box, it shows like a little printer and things on the, in the, like the left half of the book, and then the sort of main computer on the right half of the book. And so this is kind of neat because it has the whole box. I'm not actually sure what is in this blue. There's a blue box between that sort of in the middle section. But the seller is starting it at a bid of $9.99. Like that is $9.99. Because I think because the seller is kind of worried that like stuff is missing. So as is, parts only see photos. Missing left side. Mm-hmm. But I'm not actually sure that it is. I think the thing that you could get on the left side wasn't necessarily included. If it sticks at, you know, if somebody gets it for the first bid of $10, this is absolutely worth it. Because I think they're usually more. I have found other auctions for a microprocessor 1P that didn't have the printer on the left. So I think this might be like as it came, and you could buy an extra printer if you wanted.
Or no one's ever opened the blue box on any of them.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly where they're made, but they're made somewhere where the general language is not English. So I have a microprocessor 2, I think it's called, which is an Apple II clone by the same company. And the manuals are sort of hilarious. But in the chat, we are reassured that this is, in fact, a Z80 machine. So anyway, I always thought they were kind of neat. I wouldn't mind having such a thing. Okay, no further comment.
No, but I do like that our chat knows stuff and we get feedback immediately. Thank you, Sorcerer Stan.
Yeah,
that is very good.
It's so much better than waiting, because I was like, should I Google that? I wonder if it's so much easier to let other people do the work.
That's right. Okay, so I thought this was of some interest. So I was just sort of searching around and I found an auction says sealed VisiCalc 3 box for Apple Computer, Apple III, first A edition. So we have a photo of a shrink-wrapped box that says Apple III, VisiCalc 3, an introduction. And, you know, there's some photos here that sort of show the degree to which it is shrink-wrapped. So my problem with this is I know what this is. It is not VisiCalc 3. It is a training pack.
Yeah, like I can see, this is just a training thing,
yeah.
Right?
And you can sort of tell because it's in the blue box. They had a set of these that are in blue boxes. And on the front it says product training pack. On the back it says package includes VisiCalc 3, an introduction tutorial, which is a manual. It's a book. And it's a book that has like a little like a hard cardboard thing in the back, like it serves as an easel. So you can sort of set it up. And then it says, you know, system configuration needed, VisiCalc 3.
Three. So you need it.
So I worry a little bit about this. You know, this is the starting bid of $95 for this shrink-wrapped thing that is claimed to be VisiCalc 3. It doesn't, in the auction anywhere, say that it is the training pack. Mm-hmm. But in fact, you will be disappointed if you get this intended to buy VisiCalc 3. Mm. So
unless you were opening up a VisiCalc training facility.
Right.
As a new business post-COVID, and you need this to, in which case, $95 in your business. Yep. Sounds good.
And it's sealed, so it should be sterile, right? I have another example. So if you actually wanted to do this, get VisiCalc 3, this auction, I think, is the one to do. It is a buy it now for $20. And it comes not only with VisiCalc 3, but also the training pack. So, these come in these, and this has been disassembled, so you can kind of see what's in them. But there's these kind of nice black boxes, and then a slipcover. And you know, so this is VisiCalc. I think the seller here has listed the packing list items and is a little worried that a couple things are missing. I'm not sure what is missing, though. It has the program and the sampler and a blank disk. It has the manuals and a little pocket reference. And I think that's basically all that came in the original VisiCalc 3. And then it has the training pack, so we can see what that training pack looks like unwrapped. It has a manual. So it's a much bigger box than you need for that manual.
Yeah.
I was just sort of, I kind of felt like that was a little annoying that this previous auction with the shrink-wrapped training pack was being marketed in a way that made it really look like it's just VisiCalc 3.
Right.
Am I getting close? I think I'm almost done. I'm zipping through these things.
Well, I have a question. Since you're an Apple III aficionado, do you have VisiCalc for the Apple III?
I do. I would have bought this otherwise.
Because $20 doesn't seem like a bad deal for all that.
I did sort of think about that for a while. It's like, although I have both of these things, if I buy this one, that brings my average cost down.
But it still brings your total cost up.
Yeah. Right. But, so I'll leave this for someone else to get. But, this is someone who's not selling this as an Apple collectible, I guess, because $20, if you think $20 is too much, you could bid $13 for it. But this is actually very good. Or maybe this is what they're actually worth, but ultimately, I think if you wanted one, you would wind up spending more. The next one, maybe Earl, you would know something about these, being a Commodore person. This is an ultra-rare AM expansion unit for the VIC-20. And what it is it's a box that you put your VIC-20 in, and it provides slots, which I guess you can put cartridges in. And, so it sort of plugs into the back of your VIC-20. And it actually, you can sort of see that the VIC-20, if you look at it, it's a case. So you slide your VIC-20 into the front of it. And there's a little hole in the side for the side ports, I guess. I think this one actually is supposed to have a power supply. I don't see, there is no power supply in this one. But at any rate, if you had bought this new, there would be a power supply that would also power your VIC-20. So... have you seen these before, Earl?
This looks like an aftermarket one. I could swear that Commodore made one. I was just trying to look that up while you were talking about it. I don't think I've ever seen this aftermarket one that you're talking about. But yeah, I'm looking at one that looks, I'm looking at a page here that has what appears to be an official Commodore expander box for the VIC-20, yeah. Called the VIC-1020.
Yeah, and that one does lack the power supply, but it's otherwise, I think, the same kind of concept.
Ah.
And it makes your VIC-20 look like a pet.
It does, yeah.
It's pretty cool. So it says, CBM VIC-1020.
It's got a tiny little monitor that they have sitting on top. It's dwarfed by that giant expansion box.
Yeah. So, it's a VIC-20, though.
Right.
That you're adding this to. But I found a photo in the Compute archives from 1982 that showed this aftermarket one. And AM, by the way, does not stand for aftermarket, but for Arfon Microelectronics, who make this thing. But and you can sort of see where the power supply was supposed to be in the one that's on auction. But I guess I don't actually even quite know how these work. How you choose which of your cartridges you've plugged into it is active. Because it kind of looks like on the one that is, the original auction, there's a little set of dip switches connecting to all of the slots.
Oh, right.
And I sure hope that you don't have to hit one of those.
That's not the way you do it. That's convenient.
I think it would be much more convenient to put in a different cartridge than it would be to try to poke the little dip switch.
Well, with certain RAM cards, you could put multiple in there to boost your RAM to the maximum possible with the VIC-20.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you need multiple cards on a VIC-20 to boost to the maximum RAM possible?
I think actually you do. Yeah.
It's 1K.
Yeah.
It's a VIC-20.
Now, not to say, I mean, I think that there were some RAM expansions that had all of the RAM possible in one cartridge. But some of the Commodore ones that I remember, like there was an 8K, there's a 16K, and I think the 3K RAM expander was in a different memory location than some of those others. So yeah, you might have to mix and match if you wanted to max it out, or just get one of the cards that had everything on all in one shot. But I don't know if Commodore made one of those.
I seem to recall that we had talked about, you know, 9 episodes ago or something, like a modern RAM enhancement for the Commodore that actually had a little switch that allowed you to take down the RAM, you know, so that it only had 8K or whatever instead of whatever, like the maximum it could have been. I forget exactly why, but there was some rationale for why you might want to have less RAM.
Presumably that's the same sort of rationale that gets you having a VIC-20.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, the VIC-20 experts could comment with more detail, but I can tell you that depending on the type of RAM expansion that you put in and where it was located in the memory space, it would relocate where the video memory was. So there are certain circumstances where you might want to have a particular choice of where you put in your RAM expansion so that a particular piece of software would run that is expecting the video memory at this location. Fun times.
Old computers, very, very complicated.
They're a fad. Computers won't ever catch on.
Okay, so and then the very last one that I had was nothing too exciting. It's kind of cool. It's an old Microsoft binder, Bill Gates Polyon design. Yeah,
I'm sure they personally spent a bunch of time designing this binder.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, you know, it's an interesting artifact. There's nothing in it, but you know, it's just a binder. It's like $35. So
yeah, it's a little bit pricey for just a binder, but it's a cool binder.
Yeah.
If you're gonna have a binder, if you're gonna go to a place with a binder, the binder's gonna make you friends.
Yeah,
it might be the binder you used.
You pulled that out of your WordPerfect 8 bag.
That's right.
Man.
I don't know.
I'm going to have so many friends at the end of this. It's going to be great. Yeah. You guys will see.
Anyway, so I think that's all I had.
All right. Well, while you have the microphone, any parting shots?
A good question. I've been spending a lot of time doing, audio podcast editing and things, but soon I will do things. That's my parting shot is okay. Any minute now.
That's my motto, actually. Soon I will
That'll
do
be
things.
On my headstone. Any minute now. Right.
Well, what about you, Jack?
Not too much going on. I did recently bring home an Atari 800XL that has been floating through my father's various homes for 35 years.
Cool.
So that's fun. And like, he didn't use it much ever. I use it when I would go visit him during the summertime when I was a teenager. Hmm. And at one point, like 15 years later, maybe I saw it bagged up in a storage room in his house. And I was like, wow, you still have that? And he's like, yeah, you know, I never really used it, but I kept it in case you want it someday. And now that day has come and I've got it. So
nice. Anything's retro if you wait long enough.
That's right.
Hmm. Well, Carrington, parting thoughts?
I waited long enough and now I'm retro. Woo! Nope. Did another one of those escape room virtual thingies this morning, actually. Group friends night. That was awesome. So I got on Zoom and escaped. And this is one where you have a person in the escape room and you're walking them through. They are your avatar and you can see what they're seeing and say, pick that up and do this and enter this code. And it was super fun. So I like that. Hooray for that. And spending a lot of time. In fact, after we get off the show, I'll go back to it. I'm playing The Lurking Horror, the Infocom game. It's the last of the text adventure games for the Eaten by a Group podcast. I do. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is our final one. And then we're going to do the graphical versions after this that finish off the Infocom set. But this is the last of the text only ones. So I'm super enjoying it. And I'm completely stuck. Been stuck for a week or so, but I'm just letting myself be stuck because it's my last chance to be like stuck with a brand new Infocom game. So I'm just going to ride it out.
Wow, I can't believe it.
I'm going to finish this stupid thing without cheating. So we see.
You guys did it.
And this one's great. Oh, it's so good so far.
Yeah, I'm really hoping to play this at some point. I say this every time you mention it, but on the Digital Antiquarian, there's a, you know, sort of a write-up of all the sort of like allusions that are in here, you know, because it is really,
it is super MIT. Yeah. It is MIT. You are having the adventure at MIT with real places. Yeah. Yeah. You will dig it. It is great. It is creepy and gross. I think I tweeted recently. At the moment I'm stuck trying to get by a bunch of urchins, these street urchins that have things in their back that are being controlled by a puppet master of some sort, and they're zombies. I can't get through the steam tunnel because of them. I currently have a reanimated hand on my shoulder like a parrot pointing the way, and I was recently killed by a big ball of one-eyed snot. So I'm like, welcome to this game, and it's amazing. So I'm stuck. I'm dying a lot, and it's everything you'd want from an Infocom game. It's really good. So far, I'm loving it.
Excellent.
That's it.
Awesome.
How about you, girl? Yeah. Are you ready for the tale?
Well, two really exciting new arrivals here. One is a listener, Scott, who used to listen to Retrobits. Now he listens to RCR.
And he has arrived.
He emailed me and he said, hey, I've got a K-Pro. Would you like it? Why, yes, I would. It was a K-Pro 2X, which is toward the end of the K-Pro model line. It has the horizontal mounted half height 5 1/4 floppies, and it is pristine. It's hard to describe how much this looks like you just took it out of the box, which is super exciting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Wow. Not scratched up on the outside, because the person who had used it actually had a padded carrying case that they carried it around in. So gorgeous on the outside, works perfectly on the inside. One little tweak I had to make was that the video brightness had climbed up a little bit over the years. So I popped the hood and, you know, did a little tweak with the oil stick and turned the video brightness down. It is gorgeous. And it has all the original manuals, all the original discs. I just couldn't ask for a nicer example.
Wow.
Of a K-Pro.
That's cool.
Super cool. And thank you, Scott. And I'm loving that machine.
So this is one of the blue-themed ones, right?
Not really. This one, I'll go get it in a second. When we go off the air, we'll do a little bonus footage after the official podcast. The second thing that happened was I got an email which kind of bounced around to a couple different people, but eventually made it my way, that there was someone in town that had an Altair and was looking to donate it. And so
like an original Altair?
Well, not original. It was one of the turnkey models, which has the key switch on the front and a couple of switches. And so I jumped on the email thread and said, yes, I'm here, would like to have this. And we went back and forth a couple times on logistics because COVID, but finally wound up getting over, and it wasn't an Altair. It was three Altairs. So little surprise there. One was the turnkey one that I was just talking about. Another was the actual one with all the front panel switches and lights and that, except missing the little placard on the front that says MITS Altair. So it's just kind of the metal front. So it's something that I might have to try and figure out how to restore, you know, that little nice colored placard on the front. The other is something called an ICOM Attaché, which looks a lot like an old electric typewriter with a molded plastic case and a keyboard and a video board. But you pop the hood and it's an S100 system on the inside with Altair boards. So an Altair CPU board and RAM and all that. And tons of manuals, tons of everything, diskettes. One of the Altairs was in, I don't know if you guys remember seeing this. I'm almost certain we talked about it on one of the RCRs, but the Altair that was built into a desk. Does that sound familiar? So you had a blue Altair cabinet that had an Altair 8800, and it had a dual 8-inch drive, and it's built actually into a desk, which is just cool. So that's what one of these is. And so I actually have the desk and the ginormous rack mount cabinet and all that that this goes into. So I'm simultaneously really stoked, because what a fun set of stuff to play with, and a little bit nervous because, you know, this is going to be tricky to restore. And Anyway, another cool part of this is some of it's straight from the mothership, because the person who gave it to me used to work for Pertec, which had bought MITS, and he worked actually in their Albuquerque office. And the one that I have that has the front panel switches and the lights came from the actual MITS lab where they used it as a test machine. So these machines also have a provenance that's pretty exciting as well. So that's going to keep me busy for I don't know how many months or years or whatever, trying to get all this stuff restored. And one thing that I will show for the folks on video is this is the CPU card for one of the Altairs. One thing that I should mention is that along with this, since it was used actually in the Pertec lab, I got tons of spare cards, like spare memory cards, spare CPU cards, turnkey cards, SIO cards for the serial port, which really ups my chances of getting ultimately one or two of these things to work, because I've got tons of spare parts to deal with swapping in and out or replacing chips or whatever. So anyway, that's what's going to keep me busy.
That's very cool.
Very cool.
It's like, yeah, I almost had to like pinch myself. Like, you know, I went from zero Altairs to three Altairs.
All the Altairs,
right.
And from a happy home to a very tense home. Yes.
To living in a shed.
My domestic tranquility almost took a hit, but I can't believe, you know, we talked about this before. In a previous episode, but my family has been so good, you know, supporting my hobby. But yes, a huge chunk of the garage is taken up with this now, and I need to figure out how to deal with all that.
Yeah.
But small price to pay. And that's all I had. Anything else? Or should I land this plane?
You are cleared for landing, I think.
Right. Well, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows. That's right. All of them and no extra charge at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. And you can find RCR on Twitter, as luck would have it, at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group, which is always active, always has exciting stuff going on. And a URL for that is up in the show notes as well. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We read them, we love them, and we like to steal news items from them. So please keep them coming in. We're a member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbackreviews.com. And if you'd like, you can write a review on iTunes, wherever good podcasts are sold. And until next time,
Retro Compute!